From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Today, the international finger-pointing continues around the poisoning of a former Russian spy and his daughter in the U.K. Russia called an emergency meeting of the Organization of the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, and it happened today. Moscow is demanding the U.K. share its evidence of the chemical weapons attack on Sergei and Yulia Skripal. The two were found poisoned by a powerful nerve agent 1 month ago today. The U.K. has said that it's very likely that Moscow was behind the poisoning, but Russian authorities deny any involvement. BBC reporter Anna Holligan is at The Hague, where today's meeting took place. Anna, what were the conclusions of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or the OPCW?
Manifold, actually. So we heard, first of all, from the Russian delegation saying that a number of members had supported their suggestion that everyone should stick to the rules of the Chemical Weapons Convention. Russia called this meeting, of course, as they are entitled to as a member of the OPCW. Among other things, Moscow said it wanted to know what kind of evidence the UK had provided to the OPCW, which inspectors visited the site of the attack in Salisbury, who they met, and where the samples are now being independently analysed. UK has, of course, accused Russia of using this as a platform to pump out more disinformation rather than simply allowing the independent experts here to get on with their job of verifying this substance. So in a tweet, the UK team here in The Hague said Russia's proposal for a joint UK-Russian investigation into the Salisbury incident was perverse. And they said it was a diversionary tactic. You know, earlier we heard from the Russian foreign intelligence chief who said that the poisoning was a grotesque provocation that was crudely concocted by the British and American security services simply to implicate Russia. So these are all of the kind of allegations that have been flying around here in The Hague. And we've been hearing more from the UK's representative who explained why they wouldn't be sharing the samples, at least with Russia, why Russia wouldn't be invited to be part of this investigation. And now we're waiting for the test results, the independent test results, which are being conducted by the OPCW.
And the test results are going to tell us what? Specifically, what kind of chemical it was and where it originated?
Partly. So the test results, if they're successful, will say what kind of substance this was. So will they confirm that it was a military-grade nerve agent, a Novichok of the type produced by the former Soviet Union, as the British Prime Minister Theresa May said in Parliament? They won't go beyond that. They won't attribute blame. The OPCW doesn't have the power to attribute blame. And they would have to investigate further. It may be that the OPCW would ask Russia for permission to check the former production facilities to ensure that all of Russia's chemical weapons stockpiles have been destroyed in accordance with the international protocol. Russia, if it wanted to be entirely transparent, could simply allow access, allow the inspectors to go in and do their job of verifying this. Or it could say, well, why should we? We haven't done anything wrong. It could then be that the OPCW would go further and refer the matter to the UN Security Council for a resolution to allow access. But we know Russia has the veto power on the UN Security Council. So again, if we look to the example of Syria, you can see how complex and complicated this whole matter of verifying what countries possess in terms of these chemical capabilities can get.
Anna, this is a high-stakes case of intrigue, and there is still discussion, including here in the United States, about whether or not Russia, despite suspicions, is really behind not only this attack, but the creation of this military-grade Novichok. Is there an airtight case against Russia now?
It depends who you ask. I was speaking to one military expert earlier today, and he said, this is a British military expert, and he was saying there was absolutely no doubt that the Novichoks were only produced in one facility called Shikhani in the former Soviet Union. So it looks as though the OPCW has confirmed that the existence of the Novichoks was never declared to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, in which case the OPCW could request a site visit or more information from Russia. But The meeting today was purely at Russia's request. I've got a statement, though, actually, here from the British contingent. And they've said that the idea that the victim should cooperate with the suspected perpetrator is just perverse.
The final question, what is right now the condition of the two people really at the heart of this, the Russian ex-spy and his daughter?
Well, the BBC understands that 33-year-old Yulia is conscious and talking, and that her father remains in a critical but stable condition in hospital.
Okay, thank you very much for speaking with us. Anna Holligan of the BBC speaking to us from The Hague. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, today marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Here's how CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite told the nation of King's death on April 4th, 1968.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an...
There are commemorations today in Memphis, as well as in his hometown of Atlanta and around the country. King's assassination came at a time when the national civil rights movement was in turmoil. In American cities, young black activists were feeling frustrated with the lack of progress for black people. As we hear from KUOW's Patricia Murphy in Seattle, the scene there was ripe for revolution when the Black Panthers opened a chapter in town.
Brothers Elmer and Aaron Dixon were members of the Black Student Union when Martin Luther King was assassinated. Aaron Dixon told the University of Washington History Project it was the moment where everything changed.
No longer did we feel that peaceful demonstrations was going to work, that we were now going to look towards other methods of demonstrating and getting our point across.
Just a short time later, Elmer Dixon says the brothers formed the Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. Dixon is back in the old Madrona neighborhood. In 1968, he says, members would train weekly in the playground right across from his mom's house and just blocks from a white neighborhood.
On any given Saturday, you could come up and see 300-400 Panthers up there in military formation, drilling and training. And then we would march out of the park, down 34th, all the way down Cherry to Garfield Park, where we would hold a rally.
The Panthers cut an intimidating profile in black berets and leather jackets, but Dixon says they were also required by the party to be well-versed in the law. The Panthers' 10-point program addressed safety, social needs, and the oppression and incarceration of black people.
We weren't anti-white, we were anti-system. And a lot of people don't know that about the Black Panther Party. We had coalitions with every group. In fact, the phrase Rainbow Coalition was coined by Fred Hampton, not by Jesse Jackson.
Hampton was a Chicago Panther and a leader for the National Party before he was assassinated by police in 1969. Elmer Dixon says at the time, Seattle was perceived as a quiet Northwest town, but in reality, it was politically volatile. Congressional records show there were more than 70 firebombings between 1969 and 1970.
I won't say that there weren't probably some Panthers that were involved in that, because it was hard to control 300 to 400 Panthers.
There was deep mistrust and numerous confrontations with police. Then, on a summer's day in 1968, Dixon says police raided the Panther headquarters on 34th looking for a stolen typewriter.
I came around the corner and the whole street was full of police cars. I mean, like, there wasn't a spot that wasn't taken up. And that was the day they arrested my brother and my brother-in-law, Curtis Harris, out of the office here for allegedly stealing the typewriter.
The raid sparked riots. Civilians and police were injured by rocks and gunfire. Both men were acquitted. 50 years later, Dixon takes me by the old headquarters. His mom still lives around the corner, across from Madrona Playground. The building is split into two storefronts with doors side by side. In 1968, it was Panthers on one side and a realtor on the other. Given the city's history of discriminatory housing practices, Dixon says the realtor was pretty uncomfortable.
He spent very little time here. I think he was afraid to death of us, and probably was very happy when we finally decided to move out. I got to say hello to my brother in here. He's the keeper of the site.
Ben Abe has run his travel business in the old headquarters since 1982. The realtor is long gone, and now a specialty wine store is in that space. Abe has seen this neighborhood gentrify, but he has stayed, unlike many of the black families who lived here in the 60s.
Yeah, and I own the building now.
Oh, you own the whole building?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
And next door, too.
Oh, great.
By the fall of 1968, the Panthers moved their offices into a house nearby, which would also become the city's first free medical clinic. The Black Panthers disbanded in the 80s, but the clinic remains an important part of Seattle's Central District. These days, Elmer Dixon still lives in Seattle and is still doing the work, helping police departments and cities as a diversity consultant.
And so when I look at the work that I've been doing for the last 30 years as a diversity consultant, and I look at the Black Panther Party and that platform and look at the playground that we grew up on, you know, there's a connection between all of it.
There was a little bit of everybody out here, he says. White kids, black kids, brown kids, everybody just trying to carve out their little piece of turf. For Here and Now, I'm Patricia Murphy.
President Trump and his economic advisors are brushing off concerns about the specter of a trade war with China. That's after China vowed today to slap tariffs on a range of American goods in retaliation for President Trump's plan to raise import duties on Chinese goods.
Also in the news today, the director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, says a decision has been made on when to withdraw troops from Syria, something that President Trump says he wants done quickly, even though his generals say the mission is not yet over. Let's bring in our political strategist. We've got Democrat Jamal Simmons. Jamal, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Fine, thank you. And John Brabender, Republican strategist. John, how are you?
Doing quite well.
Glad to hear it. Well, let's start with Syria, John. Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said the mission to fight ISIS in Syria is coming to a rapid end. And President Trump also spoke about that at a news conference yesterday.
I want to get out. I want to bring our troops back home. I want to start rebuilding our nation. We will have, as of 3 months ago, $7 trillion in the Middle East over the last 17 years. We get nothing out of it.
Okay, John, also we're hearing today from White House officials that troops are committed to staying in Syria to finish off ISIS. Are you getting a clear picture on what the policy in Syria is?
Well, I think what the president is saying, first of all, is correct. We've done our part. Our part for being there was to fight ISIS. We've made substantial gains. And the question is, when is the right time to leave? I think most Americans probably agree with them that once it is mission accomplished, why are we spending the money? I know they're putting pressure on Saudi Arabia to do more, which I think most people would agree with. So I think people would like to see the troops come home. I think they'd like to see that money better invested here. But I think the key is people want to make sure that our generals are being brought into this decision, that it's not premature. We saw that in previous history, we've had problems of pulling people out too quickly. So I sure hope the president is going to follow procedures as far as getting everybody involved and making sure before a final decision is made.
Yeah, so John, I just want to follow up on that point. We reported this week on a rift between what the White House is saying on Syria and his commanders are on the ground who are actually doing the work. I mean, is there a danger there, a liability that he doesn't handle that relationship right?
Well, I think one thing we've learned with this president is that he's not going to blindly follow any of his advisors. He feels that people elected him to make tough decisions, and he's not afraid to make them. With that said, I certainly hope that at the very least the president is listening to them and weighing what they have to say before he does make a final decision.
We should say that NPR's Tom Bowman was in Syria just over a month ago. He says the military told him that the hard part starts after ISIS is defeated, and the military helps with a destabilization process, and that could take a year or more. I want to turn to Russia, though, an opponent in Syria and in cyberspace regarding the elections. On his last day in office yesterday, the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, said this.
For too long, some nations have looked the other way in the face of these threats. Russia brazenly and implausibly denies its actions, and we have failed to impose sufficient costs.
And here is what President Trump told leaders of Baltic nations in a White House meeting yesterday.
Now, we want to be able, if possible, and this is speaking with the Baltic states, ideally we want to be able to get along with Russia. Getting along with Russia is a good thing, not a bad thing. Now, maybe we will and maybe we won't. And
Probably nobody's been tougher to Russia than Donald Trump.
So we're still seeing a split then between what we hear from the president and his advisors. John, how are you reading this?
Well, I do agree with the president that we should try to have a good relationship with Russia. We have many differences with Russia. Obviously, they interfered in our elections, and we can't just turn a blind eye towards that. But when you look at the bigger picture of our national defense against terrorism and those type of things, we have a lot of common enemies with Russia. And it would be a mistake to try to go down and create a new Cold War, not try to have a relationship with Russia. With that said, again, though, we need to be firm. We need to get other nations involved. And I hope the president handles this very carefully. I think his agenda is right. But sometimes the rhetoric causes more problems than it should. Sometimes the process causes more problems than it should.
And Jamal, what do you think?
I think that Vladimir Putin couldn't have a better ally in the White House than Donald Trump. Donald Trump is withdrawing the United States from every sphere he can think of international power and coordination, whether it was TPP, destabilizing NATO by pressing people so hard for the money and then not being so willing to stand up to say the common defense was where we would be. Now willing to pull us out of Syria before the job is done. Power abhors, nature abhors a vacuum. And if the United States pulls out of all these arenas, the Chinese and the Russians will come in and the U.S. power will be even greater diminished. I think he is operating as much as anybody could be on behalf of strategy that does not help the United States maintain its power.
Well, we also have a new advisor coming in, a pretty important one, incoming Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, of course, has to go through the confirmation process. But he seems to be more hawkish than Trump on Russia, especially when it comes to election interference. Jamal, I mean, what do you make of the potential for that relationship, especially on the issue of Russia?
You know, again, the president is, you know, kind of historically, he's like a Twitter thug. I mean, he says and tweets all these really tough and blistery things. But when it comes down to the actions, he doesn't really follow through himself. And so we haven't seen the president take on Vladimir Putin personally, while his administration has gone out and done certain things. The president won't fire anybody personally. He allows those things to be handled by other people. And even when he speaks to someone like Shulkin, he doesn't say, "You're fired," like he does on television. So he's it makes me wonder what we can count on from this president. And it just seems he's doing the very things that Vladimir Putin would want him to do.
Yeah, but I think in fairness to the president, what we have to recognize is he indeed has fired a number of people. And I actually
he personally.
Well, by at least at the very least by tweet. But the point is,
it's one way to do it.
He did something interesting.
Twitter thought.
A lot
again.
Of times people come into administration and they're basically allowed to live there forever to regardless of performance. What this president has said is, I've evaluated and reevaluated people in my cabinet. The ones who are doing what I believe is a good job and are following my agenda, we're keeping. Where I think we need to make changes, we're going to make changes. We see that with Larry Kudlow coming in, with Pompeo coming, all these things. And I actually respect the president for doing that, because what he's saying is just going along and getting along and being average isn't good enough in a Trump administration.
Except, the geopolitical stance of the United States is to withdraw our power from the international sphere. That is very dangerous for the globe.
Well, but I think the president would tell you is that he's contextually looking at this differently. Not that we're just going to go all over where there's a problem, but look at this in what is in the best interest of America. That's the whole idea of America first. It doesn't mean to just come home and forget about the rest of the world. It's saying we're going to do our share. We're going to look at how this is in context of this country, and we're going to start forcing some of our allies not to just say, oh, let's let America do it again.
You know, this ties into something else that the president has been talking about a lot lately. For the third day in a row, he has talked about this caravan of Central American migrants trying to make its way up to the United States, and he claimed that he got Mexico to intervene.
I said, I hope you're going to tell that caravan not to get up to the border. And I think they're doing that, because as of 12 minutes ago, it was all being broken up. We'll see what happens.
Jamal, the past couple of days, the president has been talking a lot about immigration, using this caravan as the pretext to do it. What do you think's behind this blitz?
It's hard to know with this president. It makes you wonder what else is going on that he's trying to deflect attention to. But sending the military down to the border, we know we can't do that. It's actually a lot of rules against that.
Well, the National Guard, the National Guard can go, the
but the U.S. Army can't go. But I guess the president doesn't care about the facts and details. We don't know if this caravan is coming to cross the border of the United States. There's some reports that a lot of people who are coming up from the south plan on staying in Mexico. We'll see what this actually shakes out to be. But I got to tell you, again, Fortress America, where we send the military to the borders, we go to trade wars with the Chinese, and then we pull out the United States power from around the globe, is very dangerous and destabilizing.
John, there's one theory that the president is doing this because he's been getting slammed by his supporters for signing a huge spending bill recently that did not fund the border wall that he had promised, and that he's on the defensive over that. Do you believe that?
Look, here's why I think that argument is ridiculous. First of all, everybody tries to add motivations for this president. This president ran on, more than anything else, that he was going to be strong on immigration and actually do something about the problem. He won on that issue, not in the base Republican, but he won in states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, which had not voted for a president, a Republican, since, in some cases, Wisconsin, 1984, because he was going to be strong on immigration. There's really nothing this president is doing as a president that he didn't tell us he was going to do as a candidate.
That doesn't make it okay.
But people voted for it.
Not everybody. 3 million people didn't.
Right. We became elected president based on that. And we have to.
But it's your job
that.
As a national leader to not just do the things that are easy. It's your job to do things that are in the best interest of the country, even if they're hard.
Let's just have a final, probably like 15 seconds each, in response to the move by the EPA administrator to roll back Obama-era fuel efficiency standards for cars and trucks. What's the significance of this move, Jamal?
Trying to erase Barack Obama from the history books, and they are going to poison us in their pursuit of that.
John, you're up because we don't have a lot of time.
I would argue that's called the Jobs Protection Plan, where American workers' jobs are now going to be protected to a greater extent.
John Brabender, a Republican strategist, and Jamal Simmons is the Democratic strategist. Thanks to you both, as always.
Thank you.
Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Police say a woman who opened fire at YouTube's headquarters in San Bruno, California yesterday was upset about YouTube's policies and practices. Nassim Ogdam allegedly shot and wounded three people before she shot and killed herself. The victims are recovering in the hospital. Joining us now with more on this story is KQED reporter Sam Harnett. Hey, Sam.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good, thanks. Look, police are still working to figure out the shooter's motive here, but we are starting to get some clues. What can you tell us about her complaints about YouTube and what kind of presence she had on the platform?
Well, yeah, she created videos for YouTube, a variety of videos. She did these exercise videos. She did these dance videos and then stuff about animal cruelty. And so she had a YouTube channel, and she was trying to monetize it, trying to make money on the advertisements, which a lot of people on YouTube do. And over the last couple of years, YouTube has been changing how it allows people to advertise and make money on the platform. It's been making it harder for people who don't have that many views to make money. And Adam was really upset about that, and she released a video saying that YouTube was censoring her.
Hmm. Now, we're also learning today that just before the shooting, the police did have an interaction with her. What do we know about what she was doing in the hours leading up to the incident?
Yes. So on Sunday, she was reported missing by her family, which they said was odd because she usually is pretty responsive and doesn't go missing. On the morning of the shooting, she was found by police sleeping in her car, which it's important to remind people, you know, this is the Bay Area. Rents are crazy. Homelessness is a huge problem.
Not uncommon,
yeah. It's not that uncommon. They questioned her, and she was totally calm. She said she was having some family problems, and she was moving up here. They contacted her family. Her family was thanked them for contacting them. And then an hour later, the father called back and said, hey, my daughter is really upset about YouTube, and maybe that's some reason why she's up there. Right. But then keep in mind, lots of people express frustration with YouTube. That in itself is not that out of the ordinary.
Sure. Three victims taken to the hospital with gunshot wounds. They are recovering, as we said. Is there any indication that she knew who she was targeting?
No.
Or she, no.
Not at all. And that's something that came out early, which, again, in this whole incident, there was a lot of reporting that came out early that was not quite accurate about who she was or her age, her relation to the victims. So just something important to remember with breaking news like this now, with platforms like Twitter, information does get out really quickly.
What kind of questions about security are people having today? I mean, she was on YouTube's campus with a gun. Is that something that's easy to do?
Well, you need a key card to get into the YouTube campus, but there was an outdoor section by the cafeteria that she could have gotten into. So people are talking about that, but I think also people are really talking about the fact that, you know, there is lots of workplace violence in the U.S., and this is just another instance. Maybe getting more attention because it's at such a high-profile company, but just last year in San Francisco, there was a workplace violence where at UPS where three people were killed.
Sam, real quickly, you mentioned the misinformation on social media. This is Silicon Valley, you know? How are they responding to all this?
Well, I think it's bringing up some big questions about these platforms and about, you know, conspiracy theories and people being able to kind of get their own ideas out through a platform like YouTube or Facebook. And in the coming weeks, I think we're going to see a lot of discussion about how to moderate that content.
Okay. KQED's Sam Harnett, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
And today we want to spend some time talking about a way of life that is fast disappearing. Photographer Michael Krauser spent 10 years documenting ranchers in the mountains of Colorado. He published a collection of those photos in the 2017 coffee book, Mountain Ranch. In it are images of a calf nuzzled by its mother, cows being herded across a snowy landscape, fences being built, fences being repaired, fences falling down. We also see the faces of the ranchers that Krauser followed. They were making their living off the land and had done so for generations. I spoke with Michael Krauser last August when Mountain Ranch was first published, and I asked him to tell me more about the people he took pictures of.
Well, the people are of that place in every way. A lot of the older people that I interviewed and photographed were actually born on the same piece of land or next door to where they're living now and to where they worked their whole lives and then retired. They're wonderful people. Everybody that I came in contact with was kind to me and friendly, and even if they were somewhat shy, they were willing and interested in having me there to look at and document their way of life.
Were they skeptical of you, an outsider from Minnesota?
Well, you know, when I first started the project, I was actually living in New York, and I think that sometimes that kind of made its way to somebody. So this quote-unquote New York photographer was coming by, and I think maybe some people had some preconceptions about what they were going to meet. But I guess at heart, I'm a Minnesota boy, so, you know, I had a way of relating to people from more rural surroundings, I guess. They were never too afraid of me and were always welcoming, even if it took, you know, a few minutes or a few hours to get used to me.
Well, clearly they ended up liking you. You did this project, as we said, for a decade, and there's something interesting about that because you were able to track how some of the people on these ranches change over time, including a young woman who was just 12 years old when you started. Her name was Madison George.
Yeah, Madison George was a daughter of one of the families from Yampa, Colorado, that I photographed. And I made a portrait of her and some other young people one of my first visits out there in 2006. And the portrait that I made of her just stood out as one that people always wanted to ask about, always wanted to talk about. It's something about the look on her face, the gaze into the camera was somehow arresting and intriguing enough that people always stopped at it and asked about it. And when I finished the project, I realized that I'd been photographing Madison and some other people for 10 full years. And kind of in recognition and honor of that portrait and of her, I asked if I could make one more portrait of her to finish off the project. And so the last picture I made for the book was a portrait that was an attempt to emulate the original one of Madison.
So you track how she changes over time, but one of the fascinating things about the work is that in some way you have showed how this lifestyle, this job, has not changed at all over the years. Many of your photographs, as I go through the book, I can't tell whether or not you've taken this photo in 1860, in 1970, in 2016. There is a timelessness to the pictures that you've taken. Did you do that on purpose?
I did do that on purpose, and it's not really an attempt to make old-looking photographs as much as it is to take photographs that don't really reference popular culture, if you can see the difference. I really don't include any evidence of popular culture, no tennis shoes or sunglasses or baseball hats or cars or architecture or typography. It's all just the traditional elements of traditional lives. And I really feel like if you have a whole series like that, you by the end of it, you feel as though you've had a certain type of experience, I believe.
I think you're right. I think also that it comes down to essentially three main elements in the imagery, which is the men and women who you photographed, the animals that they work with, and the landscape where they're working.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
That's a good observation. There are other elements as far as, you know, photographically speaking. There's a real, I try to pay a lot of attention to things like composition and strong, simple compositions, which I actually think also go a long way towards giving an experience by the end of a book.
Let's talk about some of the photographs. The one that struck me was this picture of a coyote hanging on a barbed wire fence.
Right.
It's dead. Clearly a rancher had just shot it.
Right. Actually, the guy in the next photo shot it.
The next photo is... Oh, yeah. In fact, I'm looking at it right now. He's got a rifle slung over his shoulder.
That's it, yeah.
That's a very Western image, that picture of the coyote hanging on the fence.
Yeah, to me that was really an important picture in the book because, for one thing, it shows that I wasn't really trying to just romanticize this whole thing. It's a really rough and tough, earthy kind of subculture. Then I wanted to show that was true, and you know, there is a lot of death in their life, and I wanted to exhibit some of that just to give it a sense of truth.
There's another photo of a rancher. All you can see is his hand, and there is mud just dripping off of it. And I think that's another reference to how hard the work is. I mean, we can sit here in our comfortable perches in a studio and talk about how, you know, what a beautiful life this would be, but you probably had to tackle this idea of sentimentality. How not to make this look too glamorous or something that it's not?
Well, you're right, and I also do have kind of an innate fascination with the rougher elements of their lives. So for me, it was not something I had to talk myself into to photograph the mud and blood and spit. You know, I spent a lot of days, you know, sitting down in cow manure or kneeling in it, or, you know, it's just part of the deal. And these people finish their days covered with all such things.
And the animals themselves, you can see the struggle that they go through. We mentioned the coyote, but I'm thinking about the cattle, the photographs of these cattle. You can see something going on in their eyes. You get such close-up pictures of them. Where you can see the drama they're going through.
Yeah, especially during branding. That's a tough day for those calves. And a lot of their life is calm and pastoral, but they have some distressing elements to their lives as well. And I wanted to show that too. I wasn't trying to make any kind of a point about it being a difficult world for animals or people, but it's just what I saw. And I thought it was important to relay as much truth as possible.
So in many ways, the life of a rancher has not changed, but also in other ways, everything has changed about their lives. Big questions about whether or not this lifestyle can continue itself into the future. You get into that at the end of the book, especially in some of the interviews that are done with the people you photographed. I'm thinking of Nick Struby.
Right.
He says his kids would love the ranch to take it on after he passes, but it's just not going to happen, which is a typical problem these folks are facing.
Yeah, there were a number of ways in which people expressed to me that ranching was a disappearing way of life, and one of them was this idea that inheritance taxes would make it impossible for the next generation to just simply take over. There's other inheritance issues like splitting up a ranch amongst a whole generation of people, which makes it impossible to continue, or the idea that a young person could not be a new rancher because where would they ever get the money for land and stock and machinery and such? But also there's the development of land for residences and recreational land. It's something that really sticks in the craw of these ranchers, this idea that their land is going away. And it kind of sets up a conflict with, you know, what they call rich people coming in and buying up a ranch, a whole ranch that had been used for raising cattle and simply using it for recreation two or three times a year.
Mm-hmm. Photographer Michael Krauser, the new book is called Mountain Ranch. And I have to say one thing before I let you go is that the cover of this book is so beautiful. It's a photo of a cowboy in action getting onto his horse's saddle. The cover is just so pretty. I didn't even want to put a thumbprint on it.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's a powerful photo of a young rancher named Ryder Becker who was out checking calves, and it turned out to be a really strong picture.
Michael Krauser, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Michael spoke with me last August. To see his images from Mountain Ranch, go to hereandnow.org.
The Federal Communications Commission is facing pressure from a number of fronts, including from a number of U.S. senators. They wrote to FCC Chairman Ajit Pai over his plan to cut back a program called Lifeline. Lifeline subsidizes phone and broadband service so low-income Americans can access it. The senators say cutting back the program will take away phone and internet service for millions of the most vulnerable Americans. Chairman Pai's office has said it's trying to cut down on waste and fraud. Brian Fung covers technology for The Washington Post and joins us now from Washington. Hello, Brian.
Hello.
Let's talk about some of the money and some of the numbers involved here. The program distributes about $1.5 billion in subsidies to more than 12 million Americans. How many of those 12 million would lose benefits with these proposed changes?
Well, according to the Democrats' letter, roughly 70% of those who are currently subscribed to Lifeline would lose their benefits because of a provision in the FCC's proposal that would essentially prevent a certain number of wireless carriers from reselling service that they get from larger carriers such as Verizon and AT&T.
So there have been accusations, as we said, of waste and abuse with the program. Is there any evidence that's a widespread problem?
Well, both Democrats and Republicans agree that waste, fraud, and abuse has been an issue with the program in the past. Recent reforms to the program have shaved about $200 million worth of annual spending that was attributed to waste and fraud from the program. But Republicans allege that there's more to be cut.
And what's the consequence of this? I mean, the FCC allowed a proposal to move forward that would restrict the program. It would put caps on the program and require co-pays as well. Tell us more about the FCC's rationale.
Yeah, so the big issue here is that Republicans view the program as being essentially uncapped in terms of the amount of money it can spend. It does have a budget, but there's no requirement that it stay under a certain amount. So what Republicans are trying to do with this proposal, or one of the things they're trying to do, is to establish a certain level of money that the program can't spend more than. So the idea here is that you reduce the program's spending and you thereby force it to become more efficient.
One of the other issues that the FCC is facing is criticism. After a video about the conservative Sinclair Broadcasting went viral, the clip shows dozens of local TV anchors at Sinclair-owned stations reading the same scripted statement about the dangers of fake news and media bias. Let's give a little listen.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
So what's on the screen there is anchors dutifully reading the promotional script. Could you remind us about the FCC move that paved the way for television broadcasters to own more stations? This happened in November. The issue around Sinclair is a major case in point. How so?
Sure. So in order to understand what's going on here, you have to understand that the Sinclair Broadcast Group is trying to buy up Tribune Media. And this is a $3.9 billion deal that would give Sinclair much more control over many more TV stations. And the FCC has a role here because it has to approve any transaction in which TV licenses change hands.
Which it's been doing.
That's right. And so the FCC, last year, made a couple of moves that would make it easier for the combined company to stay under, national limits on broadcast ownership. It's taken aim at, issues that prevent certain, numbers of TV stations from merging in given markets. It took aim at a rule known as the Eight Voices Rule that, says that in order for any TV station to merge with another in a market, there have to be eight voices remaining that are independent and on the air. The FCC did away with that rule, for example. And so all of this has led to questions by federal lawmakers as to whether or not the FCC may have inappropriately coordinated with Sinclair to make these policy changes that would benefit the company as it seeks to complete this merger.
And in terms of what the viewer gets as a result of all this, there was a study that came out that says that Sinclair-owned stations have their reporters or have the reporters at various stations talk more about national politics than local politics. What difference does that make? I mean, this gets to the idea of local control among stations and the impact on the audience. What's
the
significance?
Right. To date, it's been pretty apparent that Sinclair has been willing to use its control over these stations to force them to run what's called must-run programming. So, conservative commentary and stuff like that. This example here with this video and the anchors seems to be one of the first times we've seen Sinclair actually dictate to its, local TV anchors what exactly they should say, making this a pretty significant moment for the company and for these TV stations around the country that are, some of whom are saying they are worried about, their continued independence under, this merger.
At the expense of local material.
That's right.
Brian Fung covers technology for The Washington Post. Nice to speak with you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins in for Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.